If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Today we're going to talk about the management of sepsis. It has now been 15 years since the Rivers et al. Paper in early goal-directed therapy for septic shock, which is a groundbreaking paper published in 2001. There's been numerous studies coming out in the past few years discussing how management of sepsis has changed since that initial paper. So today I contacted two experts in the field of critical care, both from the surgical side and medical side of the house, to help break down what has changed in the management of sepsis. Additionally, I hope you guys are excited. It's taken us a while, but we do have some great episodes coming out. We're having a series on global health coming out, and we're hoping to get Dr. John Mira on the show. Not only will we have leaders in global surgery discussing the policy and the strategy of global health in the future, we'll also interview surgeons that are down on the ground with organizations such as Doctors Without Borders, and they're going to give you an in-depth insight into what it's really like to join these organizations, what it takes to be accepted into one of these organizations, and the physical and emotional toll that these missions take on you. And then we also are going to have a debate. Our next debate is going to be carotid endarterectomy versus stenting, as there's a new paper out in the New England Journal, and we got two of the lead authors of this paper to help bring a great debate to Behind the Knife. All right, well, enjoy this episode about sepsis.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to Behind the Knife, and we have a special episode this week where we're going to discuss the management of sepsis. And today we're really lucky to have two great contributors. The first contributor we have is Dr. Christian Jones. He's an acute care surgeon at Johns Hopkins University Medical Center. Christian is an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins in the Division of Acute Care Surgery. He also works as a trauma surgeon, an emergency general surgeon, and a surgical intensivist. He's active in social media as a member of the International General Surgery Journal Club and an executive committee and regular moderator at the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma Twitter Journal Club. And his passion is free and open access medical education. Thank you, Dr. Jones, for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks, Kevin. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Happy to be here.
And Dr. Jones, as we know, you're very active on Twitter. Can you give your Twitter handle here so people can get connected?
Sure. It's just @JonesSurgery.
Thank you. And our second contributor, we really wanted to have a broad perspective here. We typically have mainly surgeons on the podcast, but when we came to intensive care, we thought it would be important to have a medical intensivist with us. And Dr. Exline, he's a critical care intensivist at Ohio State. He's an associate professor at Ohio State in the Division of Pulmonary Allergy and Critical Care and Sleep Medicine. He's the director of the Medical Intensive Care Unit at Ohio State, and he's currently co-chairing the Ohio State's Process Improvement Project on delivering the sepsis bundle onto septic patients across the medical center. Thank you, Dr. Exline, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Great. And part of the reason I wanted to get this topic discussed was, as surgeons, I feel like a lot of times we're, especially the ones that aren't the trauma intensivists that are just managing their patients in the ICU, we're not quite as up to date on the most late-breaking processes in managing sepsis. And so just to get us started, the paper that all of us know very well is the Rivers et al. What are some of the changes? What are some of the major changes we've seen since Rivers et al?
I'll start out. So I think probably the biggest change that we've seen since Rivers came out, and Rivers is the first paper that talks about early goal-directed therapy and actually tries to come up with specific parameters that we're looking for in the early resuscitation of the septic patient. The biggest change, of course, has been basically the standardization of early goal-directed therapy. When Rivers came out, it wasn't assumed that this was the style of resuscitation that most septic patients would get. Now, this is 15 years ago now, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the more recent trials, but for me anyway, the idea that you would only resuscitate a patient based on vital signs as opposed to different lab values and invasive monitoring and so forth is almost completely foreign. And that's because, more than anything else, of the Rivers trial. That's because Rivers came out and said we really should be aiming for these more specific parameters than, say, just the patient's heart rate in treating severe sepsis and septic shock.
Yeah, I guess I would just add that I think that the other thing is it's changed our standard, and it's really changed the way we think about it. And Rivers came out in 2001, if I'm not mistaken, and that's pretty much, I graduated from med school in 2000, so there's this whole generation of like now mid-career critical care practitioners who that's all they know is kind of the Rivers mantra of how things should be done. And it really informs and the backdrop of what all the other, the Promise and Arise and Process trials we're going to talk about. They were all predicated on, well, we know Rivers does this, how do we alter it from there? So I really think it's kind of set the conversation for the last decade and a half of how we treat our septic patients.
Okay. So some of the major trials were briefly mentioned, the Process, the Arise, and the Promise trials. What have been the main takeaways from these trials?
Well, this is Matt. I'll start out just by saying the biggest thing that all these trials did was they took what Rivers had looked at and kind of asked the question, well, it's great that we're doing this early resuscitation, but are we sure we have to do everything that's in this early resuscitation? And so they started with asking, which parts of the early goal directed therapy can we leave out? Which parts are essential? And so it again goes back to starting with Rivers and everyone being online and saying, we have to do some sort of resuscitation. And then what do we have to do from there? And the reason why I mentioned that, if we go straight to the Process trial, if you look at what they were testing the Rivers protocol pretty much verbatim from the 2000 or from the New England Journal's trial compared to a modified Rivers protocol that basically ended after the fluid resuscitation and didn't include the ionotropes or the transfusions versus standard care. But I would contend, and I believe the authors of the trial have said as well, that the standard care in the later 2000s when they did this trial was very close to Rivers. So you end up not having a huge amount of difference in what the fluid administered to these patients and what was actually done to these patients during the course of their first 6 hours.
Yeah, and I think that comes back to a lot of the differences that we were talking about before with early goal-directed therapy really becoming the standard. I completely agree with Matt. Most of these trials were very well done, and they again compare to quote-unquote usual care. It's the usual care that has been changed over the last 15 years. If we were comparing all the measures in the Process or the Promise trial to usual care in 2001, I'm sure we would get exactly the same conclusions that Rivers came up with. I think the trials that have recently been published do show us one thing, which is that it's not necessarily the specific protocol that matters, but early recognition and early treatment of the sepsis.
Great. And I think that leads us into kind of digging into what really is sepsis. And the first part of knowing what sepsis is how do we diagnose this? Are we still using SIRS? Is SIRS still important in diagnosing sepsis?
So SIRS is a fantastic, easy to remember list of four items, right? And it's absolutely terrible for actually figuring out whether somebody is septic. It's something that honestly every single time I've tried to ask someone about what is sepsis, how do you define sepsis, how do you define severe sepsis, how do you find septic shock, the first thing that gets thrown out is, well, they have to meet 2 of 4 SIRS criteria. In the very first surviving sepsis campaign guideline that was included, and that's in the late 90s, SIRS itself was described in the mid-90s, and ever since around 2001 to 2002, the surviving sepsis campaign has actually said, no, SIRS is a thing, it exists, but it's not what we should be using to determine whether somebody is septic. The idea that somebody can, for instance, have tachycardia and hypotension. You'll remember hypotension isn't one of the standard SIRS criteria, but can have tachycardia and hypotension, but have a normal white count, no fever, no tachypnea, and a huge wound that's pouring out stool and pus. But according to the SIRS criteria, they're not septic, is, of course, ludicrous. The most interesting thing to me in the most recent, the 2012-2013 version of the Surviving Sepsis Campaign, is that they're actually going back to saying sepsis is a clinical diagnosis. Somebody is septic if an experienced physician at their bedside says they're septic. That's it. That unfortunately makes it a little bit more difficult for the physician who doesn't deal with sepsis on a daily basis. But realistically speaking, only using SIRS criteria to decide whether somebody is septic really only works well for gathering research over a larger population.
Yeah, I agree with Christian. And the one thing I'd add on to that is you get a lot of pushback when you just mention the SIRS criteria to clinicians because in the case of surgery, standard vital signs for post-operative patient is something I hear a lot from my surgical colleagues. Or the example I use with my med students is I'm running on the treadmill. I'm technically SIRS positive. In the case of how fast I'm running, very SIRS positive, and yet I'm not septic. I'm not even in ill health. And so I think it's used a little bit to cover us to say, oh, I don't really think my patient's septic. Whereas we want a tool that's much more getting people to think about sepsis rather than explain away the vital signs. So I think it's a start, and certainly it's something where if your vital signs are off or you're meeting SIRS criteria, you want to think about why that's happening, but I don't think it's the end-all be-all of what you need to establish a sepsis diagnosis.
Matt, I think your point is very well taken, especially on the question of the post-operative patient having quote-unquote normal post-operative vital signs, or maybe they're in some pain, so they're tachycardic. Honestly, every one of us as a surgery resident, a surgery fellow, a surgery attending has gotten a call from a nurse saying, hey, your patient was operated on at 3 o'clock this afternoon. It's midnight. They've got a heart rate in the 110s, and the first knee-jerk reaction is almost always, oh, yeah, they're in pain. Let's get them some pain medicine. Whereas, of course, any experienced surgeon will tell you, and you certainly better answer on your boards, the first answer is to go to the bedside and actually see the patient. If the patient is in pain and they're having some tachycardia, fine. Of course, you can treat it. But realistically speaking, that's not normal. There's something that's going on, and that high index of suspicion for something more than a very simple post-operative discomfort is probably a big deal. So I think that you're absolutely right, Matt, in that a lot of us, especially when having a nice conversation with our intensivists, will argue that, no, they're not septic, it's fine. But I think one of the things that we'll probably hit on multiple times today is that idea of having a high index of suspicion and the need not to simply write off an abnormality as something that's expected.
Yeah. And I think it, we really, I always end up being jealous of our cardiologists because they've gotten everyone into the thought of it's a rule out MI. So you start with the idea of this could be an MI. You understand that most of the time if somebody has chest pain, it's not going to be an MI, but you still do the first few steps to establish what's going on. And that's really how we need to think about sepsis, which is, you know, you're going to be, if you just said tachycardia, let's say post-op, or in my case, you know, tachycardia in a patient with a COPD exacerbation, yeah, more times than not, it's not going to be sepsis. But you need to think about it and at least take those first few steps to make sure you're covered. And then if they're fine, then that's great. But if they're, you know, if they're deteriorating, then you've already begun the workup and started to get some of the information that's going to help you down the road.
Absolutely. And I think that, unfortunately, though, is one of the places that the search criteria falls short for us. I think we've drummed in on wards and on our rounds exactly what the search criteria are and exactly what the parameters are, and that you need two of four of them to be meeting the definition of SIRS. I think we've drummed that in so much that there actually are people out there who are looking at a patient who very well could be septic, and they say, oh, well, they only have one SIRS criterion, so I don't have to worry about them being septic. I think that, you know, there are scores out there and early warning systems and so forth for helping to determine whether a patient is likely or not likely to be septic. But I really do think it comes back to that baseline index of suspicion and that baseline clinical judgment. And that's a hard thing to do. There's no question about it. But realistically speaking, that's the only way we can end up making a reasonable diagnosis and ensuring that the patient's getting that early treatment that they need. I love your idea of comparing it to a rule out MI. That's fantastic.
And along those lines, you're at the bedside and you're seeing this patient that has tachycardic to 115. What other tests are you ordering to confirm your suspicions or to rule out sepsis, and are you including a lactate in this?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is you approach it, and you got to be thinking, as Christian said, what's going on with my patient? And one of the best, there are a lot of alerts that can help you, but one of the best quotes I saw on an alert that was actually produced by the Epic Corporation was, do not assume that these criteria, referring to the vital signs, are a result of a condition that is already identified. And I think that's the first thing you do, which is you walk in and you say, I think I know what's going on with this patient. I think, you know, it's a COPD exacerbation, it's postoperative pain, whatever you thought the diagnosis was. We always have to be questioning yourself and saying, am I sure that that's what's going on? And if after doing a careful review, you say, yeah, I do, you know, the patient says, hey, I'm having a lot of belly pain, then you're okay. But if you're not 100% convinced you have the diagnosis in hand, then usually I will recommend getting an early lactate for two reasons. One, it's going to help you understand, you know, if they're in occult shock. Hopefully this is after you got the vital signs, so you know they're not in frank shock with a low systolic pressure. And then number two, and we'll get to this I think later, is it's going to be one of the major process improvement points that you're going to need to demonstrate for your hospital if you want to be part of the in compliance with the CMS sepsis bundle. I think the lactate can give you a lot of early information, again with the caveat that it doesn't tell you they're septic, it just tells you they're sick.
And I think that's reasonable. I will get to the idea of the CMS bundles and mandating particular areas of bundles and so forth, and I'm sure we can have some interesting discussions on that. The biggest problem that I have with lactate is, once again, the same problem that we have with search criteria, which is that I'm not sure it gives you the information that you think it gives you. I'm not sure that everyone can interpret that as cautiously as we might. There are definitely patients who have severe sepsis, as evidenced by other organ dysfunction, whether it's mental status changes, renal dysfunction, and so forth, who have a normal lactate, especially in the early stages. There are patients who aren't septic and have an abnormal lactate. Quite possibly the most frustrating consults that I've gotten as a general surgeon are the consults for elevated lactate, rule out bowel ischemia. It's understandable because honestly, all of us at some point have heard, oh, this patient has a lactate of 5, they must have dead bowel. That's not true. Matt, you're absolutely right.
it means the patient is sick. There's some sort of stress going on in the body. And the problem is that the number of the lactate, or even just the fact that it's abnormal, doesn't tell us anything about what that abnormality in the body is. Cliff Reed is a emergency medicine physician and critical care intensivist in Australia, in Sydney, I think. He is really active and was one of the first people to be active in the free and open access medical education side of things. And as we know, emergency medicine in general has done a fantastic job of that. A lot of images have been made by him. A lot of them have great mnemonics. And the one that I still use from, I don't know, 5 years ago is the lactates mnemonic, the causes of elevated lactic acid, the causes of lactic acidosis. So lactates is liver and lung disease, accelerated glycolysis. That's something that's from taking albuterol, from epinephrine, and so forth. Congenital disorders, thiamine deficiency, like we see in an unfortunate number of our trauma population. Anaerobic metabolism, of course. Toxins and drugs. Extracellular movement, that's what happens in alkalosis when you have a patient who's really ill. And the last one, the very last one in that list, is sepsis. Now, once again, I completely agree that we should be keeping sepsis on our differential and very high on our differential. The biggest concern I have, though, is when that patient who has something abnormal gets a random lactate drawn and immediately jump to the conclusion that they're in septic shock and they've got dead bowel. And that's my only concern. I think that following the lactate, there's some hit or miss on, you know, trending it in terms of guiding your resuscitation. But at least that's reasonable. At least if you are going in the right direction, you're probably doing most of the right stuff.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think much as we made with the SIRS, just checking a lactate's not the end all be all. And I would say the majority of septic patients I see are not, they don't have the lactate greater than 4 that gets you into the, you know, early goal directed therapy trials or anything like that. Their lactate's mid 2s. So it's kind of like it's higher than a healthy person, but not crazy high in the hospital. And so you don't know what to do with it exactly. So, I mean, I think it's the beginning of the thinking process, but it certainly doesn't substitute for using clinical judgment to say, hey, even though it's normal, I still think this guy is, I still think this guy's sick, or it's really high, but I don't think this guy's as bad. And from a medicine standpoint, I'm sure we might see a few more of these patients in the medical ICU. We always also have to keep in mind that lactate's turned over by your liver. So anytime you see someone with bad liver disease, those lactates are always going to be artificially high. So one of the corollary to the surgeon with the "this must be dead gut" is the liver failure patient whose lactate is like 4.5 and they're fine. It's like, well, they're just not processing their lactate as quickly as you would expect. So you always got to keep in mind the other conditions that can keep it artificially elevated.
Absolutely. And of course, we see that in the surgical ICU when somebody has some component of liver insufficiency and they look clinically great, but their lactate's elevated. And quite honestly, people can freak out a little bit. So I think the biggest concern is that, you know, sort of using lactate as some sort of screening paradigm. I think it is entirely reasonable to use as a measure of success, if you will, maybe even a measure of severity if you are diagnosing them with sepsis. I just think that using it in terms of diagnosis is problematic.
Great. And so now that we have, you know, identified how we identify our patients with sepsis, we can kind of go into the management and the initial goal-directed therapy and whether we are starting with fluids, antibiotics, placing lines. What are your guys' guidelines for this, and how do you approach that?
So, I mean, I think the first step is once you begin to suspect sepsis, realize that as we've emphasized, there's not a one dichotomous test that's going to tell you this patient definitely is infected or not. And so as your suspicion of sepsis is growing, it's okay to start some of the early resuscitative measures. And even if you're wrong and it's not septic sepsis, you're still probably going to be helping your patient more times than not. So I encourage all of our physicians to start fluids. You know, the standard is some people will use 2 liters as an initial resuscitative bolus. I'm okay if you're not sure to at least start a 500 cc bolus. And as that's running, that gives you another, you know, 10, 15 minutes to try to figure out what's going on. And then, you know, unless you can definitively say, okay, I know this patient, even though they look sick, I know they're not infected, you also want to start getting antibiotics up to the bedside. And the main reason you want to get antibiotics started early is one of the only things that's been shown to actually improve outcomes in at least septic shock. But number two, if you're like most institutions, the decision to get antibiotics, you know, if you say I'm putting them in my EMR order entry system, you still got like another 45 minutes to an hour to get the antibiotics to the bedside, to the nurse, to be hanging at the patient. So if you want to meet that early within an hour criteria, you really need to be the minute you're thinking this guy could be infected, you know, thinking about starting the antibiotics. And in the grand scheme of things, if 2 hours later you realize it wasn't an infection, almost everyone in the hospital gets a dose of Piptazo. So I'm not sure if that one extra dose that you gave your patient is really the end of the world. Christian, other kind of, from a surgical standpoint, what do you guys like to do first off?
Well, I mean, I think you're entirely right. As you know, Matt, probably the surgical step of administering fluids is very well known, and sometimes to the detriment of our patients even. I think that 500 cc's is fine. I think that most of the time when somebody tells me they administered a 500 cc bolus to the patient, my immediate reaction is, oh, are they, you know, 40 kilos? I think the biggest concern that I have with the fluid resuscitation is, of course, we do end up massively overloading the septic shock patient before going the other way. We'll need to talk a little bit more about that, but what I think basically ends up happening is that the surviving sepsis campaign guidelines and lots of these bundles that we've talked about end up recommending 30 cc's per kilo of fluid. And at least for our patients, that tends to be a lot of fluid. And that's just as your initial quote-unquote fluid challenge. That's not, you know, to maintain them with the amount of third spacing they're having. I think that the biggest problem from the surgical standpoint is that it probably is more reasonable to, along the same time you're starting significant fluid resuscitation, to go ahead and start a vasopressor. The problem, of course, being that as opposed to some other patients, surgical patients may have anastomoses or wounds or other things that are going to be significantly torn down by vasoconstriction. So there's a fine line between deciding when to start early vasopressors and when to start only fluid. We have a few different things that we know of that can help us decide, namely whether they're being responsive to the fluid or not, but again, from the purely surgical standpoint, that's the conundrum. I completely agree with you. In terms of starting antibiotics, you know, there's only two things that we do in treating sepsis that actually treats sepsis. There's antibiotics and source control. And there's a lot to be done for source control, and probably in a lot of cases, a lot more that we're not doing on a regular basis. But everything else that we do, whether it's pressors or fluid, CVVHD, any of the respiratory maneuvers that we can use, all of those are just supportive care. And supportive care is important because it's going to take some time to go through all of this. But the only things that we're using to actually treat the patient are antibiotics and source control. So I completely agree with you. Give them their Piptazo early on. nobody outside of allergies is going to have a significantly bad reaction to an extra dose of Piptazo when they ended up not being septic.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think the two things that are somehow, that are sometimes misused in this situation is one, kind of the concern of antibiotic stewardship, which is it is very important that we are judicious in our use of antibiotics. But the vast majority of antibiotic usage is not the one-time dose in somebody you thought was septic but ended up not being it. It's the three-week course of antibiotics that you just never stop. And so I think it's sometimes we take the, you know, we make it hard to start antibiotics when what we really should do is make it easy to start antibiotics and then really easy to stop antibiotics if they look okay. So we shouldn't use our fear of overuse of antibiotics to prevent you from starting them on a patient who you think might be actively septic. And then the other is I see a lot of times people see a history of heart failure. You know, as a pulmonologist, I see a lot, hey, this guy's already on 6 liters or 8 liters of oxygen. I don't want to give him any fluids because I want to put him into CHF or overload him. And I agree with Christian. You don't want to give them liter four if they're not showing any response. But I do want to empower people to say, if somebody gets intubated because they got 250 or 400 cc's of fluid as you're trying to figure out what's going on, they were heading that way anyway. So, you know, that initial start of the fluids and the antibiotics, and then you buy yourself a few minutes to think and say, is this someone who needs the full 30 cc's per kilo? And if so, let's keep it rolling. Or to Christian's point, is this somebody who's already got, you know, the ER already gave him 4 liters of fluid, so me adding liters 5, 6, and 7 is not really the answer, and I need to start him on vasopressors. But we just don't want, like, this fear of heart failure or fear of antibiotic usage to impede what we do for the patient in an urgent situation.
Well, and that's the flip side of the supportive care I was talking about earlier, right? Unfortunately, we do have patients who get fluid overloaded and end up needing invasive ventilation. We have patients who end up on high-dose pressors and get renal dysfunction. I don't want to minimize the difficulties that all of those things are associated with, but we do have that supportive care. We have the ability to maintain a person on their ventilator despite fluid overload. We end up having the ability to place them on continuous renal replacement if their kidneys are temporarily out. Like I said, that's a terrible thing, and that's a really sick thing to do. But if the alternative is complete cardiovascular collapse, it's probably an improvement. Yeah. I think, realistically speaking, the biggest problem with all of our supportive measures is that they're still not going to improve the patient. They're just going to keep them alive long enough for the patient's body to work with the antibiotics and hopefully alive long enough to get adequate source control for the patient to heal themselves.
Definitely. One thing I think is important just for the med students out there and maybe the interns is as we dive into the sort of the treatment of sepsis, when you have this patient that is tachycardic and, you know, they had a bowel resection, There's multiple other causes that could be related to this sepsis that we have to be ruling out and for their hypotension and tachycardia, such as the one we always teach is the bleeding is your first, and then anastomotic leaks and other sources. So as we're diving into the treatment of sepsis here, just keep in mind that this is after we've ruled out other sources of their tachycardia, and now we're pretty sure that they're having bacteremia of some sort.
Well, I'll disagree with you just a little bit, Kevin. I mean, I entirely agree that as a trauma surgeon, I am supposed to assume that my patient is bleeding no matter what is wrong with them. And every time I've given the, you know, introductory medical student lecture on trauma surgery, no matter what the patient is presenting as, if they were a trauma, it's caused by their bleeding. There's no question in my mind that that's the right trauma mindset. On the other hand, as an intensivist, I have to be thinking of all the other things that could possibly be going on. And so you're absolutely right. We do have to ensure that the patient is not bleeding, that the patient doesn't have an anastomotic leak, that the patient isn't, quote unquote, just in a lot of pain. But at the same time, we have to maintain that index of suspicion. So very much like ATLS tells us we should always go in order and do the airway, breathing, and circulation. Realistically speaking, on these critically ill patients, instead of going in order, we have to do those ABCs all at the same time. Luckily, we have these great teams that work with us, from nursing to pharmacy to residents, who are all able to do these at the same time. So I would say that it's not necessarily that we want to rule out the bowel leak or the bleeding or the retained foreign body first, although it's certainly important to rule those things out. I think the important thing is to be considering all of that, and as always, to keep the things that are worst and most difficult to treat foremost in your mind.
Yeah, I agree with you, Kevin. I think the other issue is, one, I'll be disboarded as a pulmonologist if I don't mention PE is also something you should always be thinking about in this kind of population. But the good news is if you're treating sepsis with the antibiotics and fluids, none of that is contrary to the care you're going to offer to those other diagnoses. So you can give yourself the, and you know, what I often see happening is they come in the middle of the night, they look terrible, you start the antibiotics, you start the fluids. By the morning when the attending comes around, you know, you figured out the diagnosis. You can stop the antibiotics or you can narrow the antibiotics, whatever you need to do, but you just buy yourself that 6 to 12 hours of care for their sepsis until you're sure whether they're truly infected or not. So I think you can, as Christian's saying, you can go along a parallel course where you're treating them for sepsis, then you don't just turn your brain off and say, this is sepsis, I don't have to think about all these other diagnoses.
Great.
I should also mention, we were talking about antibiotics and about antibiotic stewardship in particular. I'm a huge advocate for antibiotic stewardship, and I think surgeons are just starting to realize the importance of antibiotic stewardship and changing from things like the 3-week course that Matt mentioned to recognizing that, you know, 5 days of antibiotics for significant intra-abdominal contamination is probably fine. This is where, as an intensivist, I really have to depend upon my colleagues in other specialties too. Our critical care pharmacists are absolutely amazing, not only in helping with antibiotic stewardship and helping to select proper doses in a very disparate population, but also in using the local antibiograms that can vary even from unit to unit, not just in the hospital or not just from one hospital to another, but using those local antibiograms and a system to determine whether a patient should be on certain antibiotics for a presumed location of their sepsis. Is it an intra-abdominal infection? Is it pneumonia, which of course it usually is, or is it something else? And how should we change our antibiotics based on that? Matt and I have both already talked about piperacillin, tazobactam, and yes, that's certainly one of the mainstays of antibiotics in a lot of places. As I moved to Johns Hopkins, however, we actually have to get infectious disease approval here for longer-term piptazo. Yes, of course, we can start it initially if necessary, but realistically speaking, the antibiotic stewardship problem has gotten so big that ID approval or pharmacy approval is going to continue to be a big thing. It's going to continue to be necessary for us to maintain maintain against resistant organisms. So I think it's important to recognize that all of those members of the team, the infectious disease physician, the infectious disease pharmacist, the critical care pharmacist, they're all going to be necessary to help make those diagnoses. Now, help make those decisions. Now, those members of the team shouldn't necessarily be the ones waiting to make the decision in a committee format when the patient is crashing at 2 o'clock in the morning. But once again, that's a very good reason to make sure this has all been considered ahead of time.
Great.
Yeah. And yeah. So, and just even though we're taking this a little bit from a surgical bent, I will mention, and I always say piftazo as well, though it's often overused, but that's not, big gun is always not necessarily best gun. For example, if you're coming in with community acquired pneumonia as your source, piftazo is probably a bad choice, right? Because you need to cover atypicals and you don't really need pseudomonal coverage in somebody with a community acquired pneumonia. So we don't always want to just over, you know, what we use for HCAP or, you know, healthcare associated pneumonias is not what we want to use for everyone, just like Christian's saying. And the other thing, and it's not 100% supported in the data, but I think there's enough that it can help make decision is using procalcitonin as a way to try to de-escalate. You know, you start people on antibiotics, you're sitting there going, did we really help? Did we hurt? What should we do? Using a procalcitonin the next day to say, hey, if the procalcitonin is elevated, maybe it is still an infection. If the procalcitonin comes zero, probably it wasn't. So I don't use that to initiate my antibiotics. I just use my clinical judgment. But on the next day, when you're trying to sort out what happened, having that checked in the morning can sometimes help break the tie of whether you continue with an empiric course or not.
So I think we have agreed that when we have a patient that we are concerned for sepsis, that we are going to give them a fluid challenge of some sort and start early antibiotics. The kind of next area I was hoping to get into is what sort of vascular access do you require in these patients, if any, and the uses of CVP, is that still pertinent in today's resuscitation of septic patients?
So I just consult Christian to put in lines for me. I assume that's what everyone does.
So early central lines by Dr. Jones.
So here's what we come down to. There is some great literature coming out, especially but not exclusively from the emergency medicine side, again, showing that you really don't need central lines to adequately resuscitate septic shock. Now, we've known this for a long time in trauma, right? The best thing that you can have for patients is two large bore peripheral IVs. But, of course, septic shock's a little bit different. You end up administering pressors, which, again, hopefully you're not doing in many of your trauma patients. You end up needing quick access to lots of sampling, blood draws, and so forth. And you very well may end up monitoring a central venous pressure or using another invasive monitor. A lot of data is now showing that you don't need a central venous line in order to administer pressors. Pressors can be safely and effectively administered through a peripheral IV. Now, all of that said, most hospitals still have a policy that you can't administer pressors through a peripheral IV. And that doesn't get rid of the other benefits of having a central line. I have tried many, many times in many different settings to use fewer and fewer central lines, not just in my septic patients, but in all my patients. A lot of times I've been very successful at that. One of the times I haven't been successful, or one of the areas in which I haven't been successful, is the patient in septic shock and severe sepsis. It really is easier to use a central line, whether it's because you're going to be monitoring CVP or just because this is a patient in which it can be devastating if you lose access and they're truly pressor or inotrope dependent. So the vast majority of my septic patients still get central lines, preferably an internal jugular. The vast majority of my septic patients don't have ongoing CVP monitoring, but rather we're monitoring some lab values in terms of guiding our resuscitation and our adequacy of treatment. But I think in terms of access, you don't need to have a central line, but in a lot of ways it makes your life very much easier.
Yeah, and I think this is where you really want to think about your nurse as well. Because I agree with Christian, there's really good literature saying if you have a good peripheral IV, which is maybe not a 24 in the wrist, but, you know, a nice 18 gauge, that's great. But that's not kind of what the nurses have experienced. And whenever there is a pressor extravasation, that's an incident report for your nurse who now feels like they're in trouble because a bad patient outcome occurred. And so there's a little bit of you know, education of your nursing staff and everyone else around, because this will be a culture shift for a lot of hospitals. Not all. I mean, some places are already doing this, but a lot of places it would be a culture shift. And then number two, where I find there's a lot of pushback is if you tell the nurse we're never putting a central line in, that tends to be frustrating to the nursing staff who has, you know, needs for more access and is struggling to get everything administered. But if you negotiate and say, well, let's see if we can turn this guy around, let's give 6 hours. If you're, you know, if we can't get off pressors after 6 hours, we'll put the line in, or, you know, approaches a negotiation of what's best for the patient, the nurse, and the rest of the unit, that can sometimes smooth over some of the pushback you're going to get if you just walk in and say, I'm never putting in a central line again. Because I think at many hospitals, I don't know what Hopkins has been like for you, Christian, but at many hospitals, that would be, you know, pretty dramatic change from what the nurses are used to.
And I noticed you both, neither of you mentioned your reliance on CVP, and I was listening to the SMAC conference, and one of their providers said never, ever follow CVP. Can you tell us why this move away from CVPs and maybe other ways we can evaluate vascular status or volume status?
Well, I'll start by saying that Matt actually taught me everything I know about CVP in my outstanding time rotating with him during my fellowship when I got to spend some time in the medical ICU. So everything that I'm about to say, you can also blame on him for not teaching me adequately.
You showed me.
Realistically, the problem with CVP is that we still don't know where it should be in terms of sepsis. And that sounds really dumb, given that we've been told the right the numbers to use for our CVP over and over and over again in most of our sepsis bundles. And those all end up being, you know, 8 to 12, or if you're on a ventilator, above 12, or having some other arbitrary number thrown out. The problem is nothing has consistently demonstrated that those numbers are in any way physiologic. In fact, those are massive supra-physiologic numbers for the most part. You know, some people will talk about the trends in CVP. Some people will talk about just making sure your CVP isn't zero or making sure it's not 20. And unfortunately, nothing has in any way convinced me that those are the right things to do. I think Matt will tell you a little bit about the idea of a CVP rising, simply rising from whatever number it is, when you're giving an appropriate amount of fluid or a little bit too much fluid.
Yeah, I mean, I think you always shy away when you say never. I don't routinely check CVPs on all my septic patients. Even I don't check it on most of my septic patients, but there are occasions where you'll see a patient, and as Christian said, hey, they got 5 liters downstairs. I'm interested in seeing how they respond, and maybe I'll check the CVP to see, as I give the fluids, if the CVP is going up and up, that should indicate that you filled the tank, and so giving more fluids is probably not going to be the answer for you. So I think in certain patient populations, it still may have value. You got to keep in mind that the studies, no one's shown with any of the later studies that demonstrated the equivalence to the early goal-directed therapy, they didn't demonstrate that CVP was bad. They just said your clinical exam's probably as good as doing a CVP. So I wouldn't put a central line in to check it, but if you had it, you could get it easily in a certain patient if you wanted to check it, that'd be fine. To say it's never valuable, it's kind of like if I said, well, sometimes people can have a normal white count and be in septic shock, so I should never check my white count. It's like the extremes may still help you some. The trend may still help you some. But I would agree, it's certainly not a reason to put a line in, and it probably shouldn't or is not necessary to be done on most of your patients.
Yeah, I'll give you that. You know, I think there have been enough people getting away from putting a central line in for the purpose of checking a central venous pressure or for monitoring a central venous pressure, that it's not nearly as big a deal as it might have been, say, 5 years ago, when everybody wanted to follow a central venous pressure or at least trend it. You know, we've done a decent amount of work on measuring inferior vena cava collapsibility by ultrasound, on measuring fluid responsiveness using ultrasound, that it works remarkably well for monitoring fluid status and predicting fluid responsiveness. But once again, remarkably well doesn't mean better than CVP. It means as well as CVP.
Yeah.
Monitoring fluid with an ultrasound is something I love to do. It's really fun to demonstrate, you know, 50% collapsibility of the IVC, which goes away completely when you administer a liter of fluid, say. That's really interesting. But again, is it really giving us more information than, say, monitoring their clinical status while you're administering that fluid? Yeah, maybe, maybe not. There are lots of different ways we can monitor that fluid status. In patients who have other comorbidities, you might even go up to something as advanced as a pulmonary artery catheter. We used to do a lot of those, and there are still patients that I think it is appropriate to use a pulmonary artery catheter in. That said, I certainly don't think it's appropriate for every septic shock patient to have a pulmonary artery catheter. So I think very similar to what Matt was saying, there is a spectrum of disease, and more information usually doesn't hurt you. It can, but not if you're using good judgment.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think the most important thing with whatever you settle on is just that it's something that your nurses, your respiratory therapists, your physicians, your nurse practitioners, who everyone in your unit has all agreed this is kind of our measure. So if that's doing the IVC collapsibility, that's an excellent test. If you want to use the CVP, if in an ICU that's really what they seem to like, I couldn't really argue that they're making a mistake. It's not my personal practice. If it's just, hey, every hour I'm going to have the resident or the nurse practitioner assess the patient and just do a clinical exam, that's probably reasonable as well. I think the most important thing is that you're just attentive to how they're responding. And we can talk about this as we get to the bundle at the end in terms of what's going to be mandated. But I think just finding a practice that works for your unit is the most important thing.
Really quickly, Dr. Jones, could you just explain a little bit on the IVC compressibility, like where you obtain the window to see the IVC and what it means by 50% collapse versus no collapse?
Sure. So this is actually a really elegant measure. And again, that's one of the reasons that it's fun to do and fun to demonstrate. So you can actually measure the infrahepatic or rather intrahepatic, retrohepatic IVC with ultrasound. You're easily able to find that using your standard fast views and rotating a little bit medially so that you can find the inferior vena cava in the liver itself. You're just beneath the staghorns, as we call them, of the hepatic veins going into the IVC. And this is an area that, again, is pretty easy to find and therefore pretty easy to standardize. What happens normally with respirations is, because of the change in intrathoracic pressure, you get a change in intravascular venous pressure at the right atrium, which is, of course, transmitted to the IVC. So you'll actually see the diameter, anterior-posterior diameter of the IVC changing with respirations. The more you see, the more change in intrathoracic pressure there is, and by conclusion, the less intravascular volume there is, or the guess that the patient will be fluid responsive. So you can measure the actual diameter of the IVC as it changes with respirations, and that's the IVC collapsibility index. So 50% is very collapsible. Normal function of normal vascular status, you'll see less than 20% variation. So again, this isn't perfect. We initially started this with ultrasound and even with CT evaluating the vascular, the intravascular volume status of patients, and found that simply the diameter, not the change in diameter, but the diameter itself, really wasn't as accurate as we'd hoped it would be in terms of measuring fluid responsiveness. Now we're finding that this change in diameter is probably at least as measurable, or at least as accurate as the CVP. And in a lot of our experimental studies, we're actually finding that it appears to correlate pretty well with right atrial pressure on with a pulmonary artery catheter in place. So it's easy to measure, but it's not easy to measure for somebody who doesn't do ultrasound, you know, at all. So just as Matt was saying, this is a great way to measure fluid responsiveness if it's something that you're comfortable with and if it's something that your entire team is comfortable with. It does my patients absolutely no good for me to measure their IVC collapsibility every morning on rounds and to leave the ultrasound machine with somebody who doesn't know how to use it for the rest of the day.
Great.
And Kevin, can I?
Yeah.
I just one quick plug. I have no financial stake in this, and it's actually a free app. But Christian did a great job describing the maneuver. Ohio State, if you go to the App Store and do point of care ultrasound, there's an excellent app for your iPhone that shows you the collapsibility that Christian was talking about, and then also, like, here's where you should put your probe. So if you're somebody who's used this some, or you just need a refresher, or you're trying to show the views to someone else, point of care POC ultrasound is a great app that Dave Boehner here made that can shows all the ultrasound views, but especially for doing the fluid assessment, it's a very cool resource to have, and it's free.
Oh, that is awesome. We will definitely, we'll put that on a link to the episodes on the website here too.
That'd be fantastic. Thanks.
And so now that you have your collapse IVC, it's a 50% collapse. We're using our bedside ultrasound now. What fluids are you guys using to plump that back up?
Matt, what are you using these days?
Normally I'm using lactate ringers. When we were on saline shortage, we would use whatever fluid we could get. I think the pharmacists were making something with baking soda down in the lab. Usually we'll use LR. I think for the first couple liters of fluid, it probably doesn't matter what you pick. But we like LR, and I know, you know, there's been one trial that looked at using LR versus the issue is the how chloride heavy the fluid is. So if you have chloride rich fluid like normal saline, or, you know, 4% albumin, how that compares to your chloride poor fluids like bicarb, or excuse me, like lactate ringers, or like the 25% albumin, or like a plasmolyte, to use another commercial prep. And so there was one study that looked at if you use chloride poor fluids, you had less incidence of AKI. Just recently, there was another trial in, it was in JAMA. I can't remember off the top of my head. We can pull that up for you guys. That showed that in a cluster randomized trial, there was no difference. So it may or may not be helpful to use chloride poor fluids, but if you're in doubt, they cost the same. So that's why I tend to go with the LR. How about you?
Yeah, I would agree with you. American College of Surgeons, you know, changed their recommendations just a couple of years ago away from normal saline for fluid resuscitation, whether that fluid resuscitation is in trauma or septic shock or for some other reason. And it's exactly for the reasons that you mentioned, that the chloride-rich fluids not only seem to be associated with more renal injury, but also with a pretty significant hyperchloremic acidosis. Now, you're absolutely right. If you end up being short on fluid and give the patient 2 liters of normal saline at the beginning of their resuscitation instead of LR, you're not going to do any harm to that patient whatsoever, at least not anything that I can imagine. You may do some more harm by administering other fluids. Starch, that is like Heta starch and Hespan, again, to use a commercial name, have been pretty widely discredited in terms of resuscitative fluid. I would not in any way recommend using those, though there are still some areas out there that do them. There are some units which very early on will try using hypertonic fluids, whether it's 25% albumin or hypertonic saline, early in the resuscitation, the goal being to decrease the amount of fluid overload or interstitial fluid overload that the patient's going to have, and in theory pull that fluid back intravascular. The problem is, of course, that all of that is very short-lived and can actually end up in the long run causing the patient to be more fluid depleted intravascularly as the ions actually normalize. So I'm with you, Matt. I think LR or other, as we call them, balanced salt solutions are the way to go. And outside of that first couple of liters that you're giving, I think it's actually really important that we do that. I think this, you're right, the studies aren't perfect and they're not conclusive yet. But once again, we certainly don't have any downsides that we know of at the moment to using LR. The concept of using avoiding LR in a patient with a high lactate because you don't want to raise the lactate is pretty silly. The concentration of lactate in LR is much, 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 much lower than physiologic lactate. So again, don't stress out about having a patient with a lactate of 5 and not wanting to give them lactate to bringer.
Yeah, that's a great point. The other thing I sometimes hear is I'm worried about their kidneys, their potassium's high, and there's potassium in LR. And always remember that, again, the potassium in LR is, I think, 4 milliequivalents, which means if you replace the patient's entire blood volume with LR, the potassium would be 4. In other words, probably right where you want it. So you're not going to make someone hyperkalemic with LR either. And just to, for completeness sake, it was the split trial, which was JAMA 2015, if you want to see the latest on the randomization of normal saline versus versus balanced electrolyte solution.
Now, are either of you, some of the situations that I've seen albumin or hypertonic saline used have been in, say, the post-op lung patient, the open abdomen patient, or maybe a patient with a tenuous pulmonary or heart status? Do you guys use those for any of those situations?
Sure. So we're intensivists, which means we're supposed to love albumin. and we're supposed to throw albumin at anything that either we don't understand or can't fix otherwise. There was a great Gomer blog a little while back about an ICU fellow who decides to use albumin when his first date isn't going well. Realistically, though, for the most part, most of the albumin that we use is just saline. The 4% or 5%, the quote-unquote salt-rich albumin, that gets used for fluid boluses, that's not very much albumin, and it doesn't do a whole lot that normal saline doesn't. Most of it, in fact, is just dissolved in normal saline. The 25% or the other hypertonic fluids, again, I think the most bang that you're getting is sort of the immediate treatment, and I really do think that it dissolves out. That is, that osmotically, it ends up making less of a difference than a lot of people think it does. I won't go so far as to use the phrase voodoo, but I think there is a certain component of superstition to it. I'll tell you, when I was a resident and a fellow, I always used albumin boluses in liver transplant patients, mostly to make the liver transplant surgeons happy. Whether that actually ends up improving the outcomes, I think there's absolutely no data for.
Great.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, occasionally you have patients where their albumin, their personal albumin is on the floor, and you've given them LR for a couple liters, and you want to try something different. Totally reasonable. Probably doesn't have any data to support it one way or another. It's one of those things where we want to normalize. Like, we see a serum albumin is low, and we want to make it better because we think that'd make it you know, make the patient better, but it, we can't normalize it, and there's no evidence that given the albumin even moves the needle one way or another. So if you want to try it, you can. The biggest downside is just from a healthcare system standpoint, it's a lot more expensive than your crystalloid solution.
And what values are you guys using lab trends to determine, other than, you know, the obvious clinical signs of your patients getting better, between the lactates, the base deficits, the pH, the SVO2s, what are you relying on primarily?
So from a medical standpoint, I try to get rid of as many labs as I can, as soon as I can. I mean, obviously, if their white count's sky high, you're going to be following that. If their lactate's really high, you're going to follow that, at least initially, to see, is this trending up and up and up, or is it starting to trend down, or at least, you know, is it flat? And then if you have an organ-specific injury that you're tracking, you know, AKI or something, obviously, you're going to be checking your creatinine. But in terms of, like, serially sampling something, you know, I'm usually trying to use as much the clinical exam as possible, and we'll even try to get away from doing a lot of ABGs if we can, and just using the pulse ox if the patient has reasonable gas exchange. I think there's a danger when you get a lot of labs that it's going to prompt you to do activities, as Christian said, may be helpful but may not be. So we try to minimize the amount of data that your brain has to process in any given time.
I think that's a perfect point. Again, Matt, I think, has done a phenomenal job of sort of modernizing the sepsis treatment side and the sepsis monitoring side. Quite honestly, typically in the surgical ICU, we end up being a little bit behind the times in terms of monitoring more lab values that we may or may not need to. I obviously agree that the clinical exam is extraordinarily important. I have gotten away from doing more than a couple of lab tests in order to establish a trend, or at least an initial trend. That is, most of the bundles will still have you try to quote-unquote correct the lactate, or at least show that the lactate is downtrending. A lot of people I know swear by following the base deficit on a patient. And of course, they're all surrogate markers for just how the patient is doing, how the patient's circulation is working and oxygen delivery is working. And as long as we're using a surrogate marker for oxygen delivery and oxygen utilization, one of the mainstays of my intensive care practice is the central venous oxygenation. I love measuring and I love teaching about the central venous oxygenation and the ability to help determine not only oxygen delivery, but oxygen utilization. The idea that you can use, you know, one measure not only to determine what the peripheral milieu is like, I love that word, by the way, milieu, but also what the cardiac activity is like. So I probably get more central venous gases on my patient than pretty much any surgeon I know, only to monitor that central venous oxygenation.
Yeah, I agree. I think it can be very helpful, especially on those patients that have multiple comorbidities. So you're like, I can't tell, is this mostly cardiac? Is this mostly septic? You know, and it really gets to the point of the milieu of whether they're the cytotoxic hypoxemia, where changing their physiologic parameters is not going to improve your aerobic metabolism any. So I do think that's helpful. I don't think you, at least in my practice, I don't think you need to check it on every patient every day, but especially on patients where they're not improving as rapidly as you'd hope, that can be very helpful information.
And then one thing that we haven't quite talked on yet is the use of vasopressors in patients and kind of what the first line vasopressors are. And then not only that, when are you initiating these? And what are your blood pressure goals? I know a lot of we're being more acceptable of hypotensive resuscitation, especially in some of the trauma patients and the ruptured AAAs and things. So what are your guys' choices for pressors and what are your goals?
Sure. So hypotensive resuscitation is an excellent concept for patients that are bleeding, or for patients who are at high risk of bleeding, such as the aortic dissection, for instance. hypotensive resuscitation, I don't think is appropriate for patients who have an abnormal hypotension. That is a hypotension that's due to vasodilation, like in septic shock. Now, I'm going to switch that in a minute, but what I'll start by saying is most of the guidelines tell you, including the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines, tell you that we should be aiming for a mean arterial pressure of 65. Some older guidelines that are still used will specifically suggest a systolic pressure of 90, and that if you're not achieving that with that initial fluid challenge, that you should start pressors on the patient. Now, to flip on what I said, I don't think every patient actually needs a systolic of 90 and a MAP of 65. I think if you're trying to make a pressure that is perfect for every single patient in the world, you've first of all got a fool's errand, but 65 probably isn't a terrible number for mean arterial pressure. I think, though, that if you do have a mean arterial pressure of 60 in a patient who's awake, alert, and conversing with you, but happens to have severe sepsis, I don't think that starting a pressor on that person is the right answer. I think that, once again, it's cliche by this point, but I do think you have to use your clinical judgment and your clinical exam to decide on that. I think that using a pressor is much more important than most surgical intensivists would have you believe or would want you to believe. And of course, it's for the same reasons that we've talked about previously. Patients who have undergone surgery have complications from having high-dose pressors. Bowel anastomoses break down, wounds don't heal. We've unfortunately all seen patients who are on very high-dose pressors who have limbs or at least digits that gangrene, and that's a problem. But once again, if you don't have a choice other than complete cardiovascular collapse, I still think that's the right choice.
Yeah, I think in terms of targeting MAP, I agree with everything Christian said. But I'll take pressor choice, which is really, the guidelines will tell you, and I think most data will tell you, Levofed should be your pressor of choice out of the box. And the only time I see that not happening is sometimes in some hospitals, like they'll end up using dopamine first, and I think it's an access that they can get access to dopamine on the floor or in the crash cart faster. And the downside with dopamine is, one, you know, it doesn't have as much of a peripheral vasoconstrictive effect. But then number two, you know, a lot of these patients who you're going to be dealing with are septic. They have other, you know, comorbidities, especially cardiac disease. And you just, your rate of supraventricular tachycardia is AFib or otherwise. And then your rate of ventricular tachycardias with dopamine is just so much higher. So we usually would like to start with Levo. And then if Levo's not getting you there, you could add some vasopressin, or, you know, second line is pretty much epi, which is just, you know, it's God's pressor, right? It's what our bodies are designed to use. So, you know, it's not very often that you have to use an epi drip in a septic shock patient. And when you do, you probably should be discussing goals of care with the family at that point. But at least I think starting with Levo, having vasopressin as your background, and I'm really trying to avoid, unless specific situations, using the dopamine or dobutamine would be best.
Yeah, the other thing I'll mention there, of course, is the issue of the vasopressin. For a long time, vasopressin was considered, you know, absolutely critical for septic shock because of the quote-unquote depleted vasopressin stores in the body when a patient is severely septic. Most of that probably isn't as important as we used to think it was. It's still recommended more as a, if you feel like doing it, go ahead and do it, addition to Levofed, or to norepinephrine, rather. Quite honestly, sometimes it ends up on my patients and sometimes it doesn't. The only patients where I really stay away from it are patients with particularly tenuous bowel disease, whether it's somebody who's had mesenteric ischemia or somebody who's at high risk for mesenteric ischemia, and I will end up avoiding it in those patients. But again, remember, we're using it at a set dosage, a relatively low dosage of 0.03 to 0.04 units per kilo per minute, units per minute, and that does give us the opportunity to use it in patients that under a lot of circumstances might be considered not candidates for vasopressin. Again, the data is a little iffy, but realistically speaking, if you end up using it on your patient, there are some patients that are going to benefit from it, and we don't really know who those are.
Yeah, and that's actually a great segue to the other thing that always comes up with pressors, which is when do you decide to try, if they're refractory, when do you decide to try steroids? And so just mentioning that if you're in refractory shock and there's some fudge factor about what is a pressor refractory shock, you could consider giving stress dose steroids to those patients. I tend to, if somebody's on chronic steroids, be much quicker on the trigger to do that. Or if somebody's been on pressors and we just can't seem to turn the corner, I'll try it. But much like vasopressor, there are patients who definitely do improve when they get steroids. We're just not very good at knowing who they are, and doing a stim chest doesn't really help identify those patients either. So don't bother doing your cosentropin stim test. Just if you think they need steroids, try it for a few days and see if that improves their vasopressor need.
And how about nutrition while on pressors?
Yes, give them nutrition while they are on pressors.
Just that easy. I will defer to the surgeon on when to feed somebody.
So, I mean, that was always the big thing, right? You don't want to cause bowel ischemia or mesenteric ischemia, but remember that this is the only way that the bowel is actually getting fed as well. There still ends up being all the questions about translocation, about high dose versus standard dose pressors. And of course, remember, these are sick patients. Some of them are going to be on high dose pressors. Some of them are not. You're not necessarily as worried in these particular patients about giving them adequate nutrition for themselves. That is, hopefully, they're not going to be in septic shock for weeks on end. But it is reasonable to give them enough nutrition that their bowel does stay alive and continues to maintain its barrier function. So every one of my patients that's on pressors, unless there's some other contraindication, gets at least trickle tube feeds.
Yeah, and we should mention when we say nutrition, it's enteric, because obviously you would think long and hard before starting parenteral nutrition in a patient, certainly if the patient's infected, but even not, you'd have to be really down calorically to say that's the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
So, Dr. Exline, can you tell us a little bit about the CMS bundles and how this is going to affect our practice in the future?
Yeah, so one of the reasons why your hospital administrator might be more interested in how we're treating our septic patients is that, much as they've done for pneumonia and heart failure and other interventions, CMS has started to look at how we're delivering care from the sepsis bundle. So the positive side is that CMS is taking a strong interest in how we're treating septic patients. The downside is a lot of the bundle is coming from some of the early goal directed therapy initiatives that we're not entirely sure are still the exact right things to do. So what CMS is asking us to do is within the first 3 hours of a patient being identified as septic, we need to check a lactate, we need to draw blood cultures, and we need to administer broad spectrum antibiotics after the blood cultures have been obtained. We could talk about some of the issues with this after we run through them. And then within 6 hours, if the initial lactate was elevated, you need to repeat the lactate. And in addition, if the patient's in shock, within 3 hours, you need to give a 30 cc per kilo initial fluid bolus. And then if they're still in shock, within 6 hours, you need to start vasopressors and then do some sort of assessment of their volume status or their tissue perfusion check. So you know, what we've been talking about, a lot of this all is very in keeping with what you would do clinically, certainly checking the lactate, getting your blood cultures. Now, the surviving sepsis guidelines would tell you give antibiotics if you can't. Try to get cultures first, but if you can't get the cultures, give antibiotics soon. And the CMS bundle is going to emphasize getting the cultures first. So there's a little bit of a difference there. And then as Christian talked about, the repeat lactate within 6 hours, there may or may not be as much data of why we should do this. The hard part's going to be giving the initial fluid bolus of the 30 cc's per kilo for septic shock. As we talked about, that, you know, not every patient may need that specific amount of fluid. And then the last part comes in that 6 hour window, which is the assessment of what we're going to do for volume assessment. So initially the bundle was going to be pushing the CVP, and then later iterations now are giving you a choice of a couple different ways of doing a volume assessment, which could be a physical exam by an MD or a acute or an advanced care provider, like a nurse practitioner or a PA, or documentation of a CVP, or a central venous oxygen, or a bedside echo, or doing a passive leg raise. So you got a number of choices, and you have to do a couple of them to get qualified for that six-hour pressure check. So it's going to be a challenge to a lot of groups, both documentation-wise, the document that we're doing all this, but then also getting all this done in 6 hours from when we identify sepsis, which is when someone puts in the chart, I think this patient has sepsis. So, you know, if your ER resident opens a note and says, you know, suspect sepsis in the ER, the clock starts then and your hospital has 6 hours to deliver all these measures.
Wow. That is quite the goal.
Yeah, I think the big thing, and what I've been telling our groups is at Ohio State, we've been working on this a lot, is the main thing is focus on doing the right thing for the patient. And if you're doing that, if you're identifying sepsis and you're doing the right things for the patient, the compliance with the bundle will come. You'll hit most of these measures just by being astute clinicians who are doing the right things when you suspect an infection.
Great. And one thing that we have kind of left off in one of the main points in controlling sepsis, especially in the surgical patient, is controlling the source. And Dr. Jones, how do you go about ensuring that you have source control?
So the only two things that we can do to actually treat sepsis are source control and antibiotics. We talk about antibiotics a lot, and there's indeed a lot to talk about. But without adequate source control, in most cases, antibiotics won't cut it. Now, I say in most cases, and to be honest, that's a little bit of blasphemy coming from a surgeon. It's always source control, source control, source control, source control. But if a patient has a pneumonia, and that's 50% of severe sepsis and septic shock patients that suit a pneumonia, we don't tend to do a total lung explantation to remove the source of their infection. So yes, realistically speaking, it's not always just source control. Source control is really obvious at some points. If a patient has an intra-abdominal process, whether it's diverticulitis or a bowel leak or even appendicitis or cholecystitis that's leading them to severe sepsis and septic shock, then we know the surgeries that have to be done to fix that. If a patient has a giant abscess from which they're getting systemic disease and thus sepsis, we know how to drain that adequately. If a patient has pneumonia, we know that there's not much source control that can be done for that. And again, we have an answer. I think the biggest problems that we have are ones we don't often enough think about as sources of severe sepsis. The most obvious choice of that is central lines or other access items. If you have a patient who's severely septic, any of those things that were in place before the patient became severely septic need to be removed. And that may be a tunneled central line, that may be a portacath that's implanted in them, that may be a dialysis catheter. These are all things that quite honestly, are pretty painful to remove, especially if they're not the source, because you're going to end up needing them again, or they're going to be difficult to get access in. There's lots of information about salvaging such devices, but that information is in patients who are bacteremic without severe sepsis and septic shock. In the severely septic or the septic shock patient, you have to remove potential sources and not just assume that it's something else that's causing the problem. I think as we use more tunneled central lines especially, I kind of feel for Matt and the rest of our colleagues in medicine, because I've been there. I know how difficult it is for them to contact surgery or interventional radiology or the team that needs to remove those tunneled central lines and have that team say, no, it's probably not that. We can just leave that in place because the line looks fine. That's the wrong answer. The right answer is this patient is very ill, and we're going to do everything we can to make them better. And sometimes that's, you know, coming to the bedside, doing a little dilation with a Kelly clamp, and removing that tunneled central line.
Well, great. I think we did a great overview of the kind of the up-to-date management of sepsis, and we really appreciate our experts, both Dr. Jones and Dr. Exline, for helping us here today. And hopefully in the future we're going to come back and bring you some of the updates in managing ventilator settings in the critically ill patient. And like with all of our podcasts, we end with the final five, and so we're just going to go back and forth. And Dr. Jones, what do you listen to music in the OR, and if so, what type of music do you listen to?
So yes, I listen to music in the OR. If it's an absolutely critical high stress case, we turn the music off, but most of the time we have music on. If I get my say, it tends to be classic rock, but more and more as time has gone on, I've tried to let the rest of the team, especially the senior resident, operate with me, operating with me, choose whatever music goes on, though I will admit I maintain veto power.
Okay, number two, Dr. Exline, can you tell us about a hobby, talent, or interest you have outside of medicine?
So as most, as you get older and your kids get older, most of your hobby is shuttling the kids around, but not doing that. We like to do homebrew. A couple of us here at Ohio State get together and make beer, and turns out fairly well. So it's a good Christmas gift basket item to give out instead of baked cookies. So,
what's your favorite brew that you've made?
So I made a clone of the, for those who are in the Midwest, the Great Lakes Christmas Ale is a big seller around this time of year out of Cleveland. And so last year we made a clone of that that turned out pretty well, a little more spice than the original had, but we were pretty proud of that one. Otherwise, anything stout is pretty good.
Yeah, agreed. Dr. Jones, number three, can you tell us about a favorite trip or vacation that you've been on?
Sure. I'm actually a really big staycation fan. I absolutely love taking time off, and whether it's, you know, getting some work done around the house, or more likely just sitting around and not having to do anything or have any responsibilities, you know, where the biggest, most difficult thing I have to do for a week is binge watching Jessica Jones. I love the staycation.
Great. And Dr. Exline, number four, if you had not gone into medicine, what would you be doing?
I have the nerdiest answer for this, which is my senior year of college, I took a mathematical modeling class, and I'd already gotten accepted to med school. It was the spring semester, and I thought it was the coolest class ever. So I think kind of using that math to solve a lot of different problems would be a lot of fun. And so that's what even as I was starting med school, I'm like, if I had taken that class earlier in my college career, who knows what I would have done. But I think using computers and modeling things that way would be where I'd gravitate.
Great. And number five, our last question. Dr. Jones, if you could go back in time and see yourself on the first day of internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
It would be the same piece of advice I have given countless interns now and other residents, which is no matter what you do, you are going to be yelled at. Somebody is going to yell at you for making choice A versus choice B, and somebody else will yell at you for making choice B instead of choice A. Knowing that that's the case is actually really liberating. You're going to be yelled at, so just do the right thing.
But in the defense of your attendings, you were cutting those tails very short on the night. You really need to extend those.
Fair enough.
Well, Dr. Jones and Dr. Exline, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this in-depth review of sepsis, and I hope to have you guys back on more to talk more about critical care.
Yeah, this was fantastic. Thanks so much.
Great.
Thanks very much, Kevin.
Until next time, dominate the day.